One of the questions that we, with curiosity, ask ourselves periodically through life, but particularly when you're a kid at school and you talk about these things, is this. If the world was about to end, whether you just had just 1 hour's notice, a week, a year, whatever it might be, what would you do? The world's about to end, what would you do? In the late 1990s, there was a film made from Hollywood called Deep Impact. Morgan Freeman was one of the stars, and he was the US president tasked with dealing with an ELE, E-L-E, extinction level event. A meteor was headed towards the world, the Earth, and if it hit, it would just totally destroy planet Earth. And the film was all about this, and what the government would do, how they would plan, the activities that they would encourage people to engage themselves in, the order that they would pose, the steps that they would take. And it looked at this on an international level, and it looked at it on a personal level. And one of the key stars in this film, Tia Leone, was, I think, one of the stars. One of the things for her was she decided to spend the final hours of her life with her father, healing a relationship that was truly broken. When you think about those sorts of things, it has a tendency to focus our minds, to challenge us as to just what our priorities are in this life that we have. Well, in the passage that was read to us by Phil, you get the sense that Paul is writing in the light of just such an imminent world-ending catastrophe. Time is short, he says. This world in its present form is passing away, he says. And the issue that he's addressing with all of this going on in the background is relationships. He's addressing marriage and singleness and the importance of all of these things. Now, people have concluded by this passage that Paul is so obsessed with working for the Lord in the light of the world that's to come, and that so much so that he obviously thinks that the world is going to end within his lifetime. So he's challenging everyone, put these things aside, just concentrate. I want to ask the question this morning, is that the correct assessment of what's taking place? Is that Paul's simple obsession, or is there more going on here? So we're continuing with 1 Corinthians. And in the first six chapters, we've looked at Paul challenging unacceptable behavior in a whole series of areas. The first six chapters might have been quite scathing, having a go at the people and saying, come on, you need to put this straight. But in chapter 7, the tone of his conversation changes. And all of a sudden, he's now dealing with matters that they have raised in a letter. Chapter 7 begins, now for the matter you wrote about. Chapter 8 begins, now about food sacrificed to idols. And here in verse 25, as he's starting a new subject, he says, now about virgins. So this is a subject that they've raised, and it's closely linked to what's come before, marriage, widows, singleness, and so on. What appears to have happened is this. Someone has made the suggestion that it is good not to be married. And the reason for that is they've suggested basically that sex is bad. Now, I did explain this when we looked at the earlier part of this chapter, but if you weren't here last time, let me recap. Within Greek culture, there was this new idea, this philosophy that was developing called dualism. And dualism states that there are two big opposites in the world. There's the physical, earthly world, all the stuff that is around us, and then there's the spiritual world. And if people want to gain that higher level of spirituality, they need to leave behind the earthly. And sex was definitely regarded as being the earthly. They'd concluded it wasn't good. Avoid it. It is sinful. So much so that they were urging Christians either to celibacy, or, if they were already married, to abstain from intimate relations. And some were even saying, go further, get a divorce. This was their new way to holiness, this new higher spirituality. Well, in the first 24 verses, Paul has dealt with that question for the single, for those who are married, for those who are widows, on whom there was great pressure by society to remarry, which contrasted and flew in the face of this challenge not to get married because of how bad that was. What were they to do? And Paul's conclusion to all of them was this: physical relations are not bad. They're a gift from God. So whatever status you've held previously, just remain in that condition. Now we come to this passage, verse 25. Now he's writing to a new group of people. And the NIV describes them as virgins. And his conclusion for them is almost identical to this new group from what it was from the old ones. Stay as you are. So in verse 27 we read, are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not seek a wife. And if you've been listening carefully to what I've been saying, you must be thinking to yourself, hang on a minute, virgins? And he's talking about, are you married? That's not consistent. What on earth is going on here? Can I give you a warning, a helpful warning? Be really careful about just how literally you read the versions of Scripture that are in front of you. This is the living Word of God, but remember, you're reading an English version of it. Paul was not writing in English. This is not the original. And unless you've got the Greek in front of you, it's subject to uncertainty or error in translation. In this case, the NIV's translation is not helpful. It could be a word that relates to people who are virgins, but that misguides you on who he's speaking to. The ESV, that's the English Standard Version, translates betrothed and goes on to say, are you bound to a wife? In other words, are you engaged to a wife? Others say to unmarried people who are about to be married. And whether you're reading the ERSV, the NRSV, or most modern translations, they give verse 27 as this. Are you bound to a wife? Are you engaged, in other words? And even our NIV, the new version of the NIV that's been around for about 3 or 4 years now, says, are you pledged to a woman? If you are, do not seek to be released. This is the group that he's speaking to. Be really careful about how literally you take every single word. It's why we must read Scripture carefully in its context and understand what's behind it. What seems to be going on here is this. They have written to him with an example of someone or some people who are about to get married. Presumably, therefore, in the light of this dualism thinking, sex is bad, they're saying to them, should this go ahead? And Paul writes, don't go out of your way to change your status. If you're engaged, carry on, don't break it. But he also wants to be balanced. He wants to make sure you're not just reading things from their particular perspective. So he says, if you're single, don't go looking for a wife. Don't change your status. Please understand, therefore, that this is not Paul writing a forever to be written in stone eternal judgment on the rights and wrongs of marriage or celibacy. The context that he's writing in is in response to those who've written about a problem, this idea of dualism. That's what he's writing about. And that's the reason that when you read verse 28, he says, but if you do marry, you have not sinned. Why else would he write that? That would be a ridiculous notion for anybody else to suggest that being married would have been sinful. It'd be ridiculous for a Jewish man in this culture, for whom marriage is not only the normal practice, but in many respects is viewed to be next best thing to obligatory. The only reason he writes that is because people have challenged it, the idea that sex could be bad. Notice something else that's important to us to grasp in this. When it comes to whether or not anybody should get married or should stay single, Scripture gives absolutely no directive. Christians are entirely free to choose. And so here, Paul's advice is just that. He's giving his personal preference, his opinion. In the previous section, when he was talking about marriage, God has spoken loud and clear about marriage. So there he was giving an instruction. I'll read to you, remind you what it said in verse 10 of this passage. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from a husband. And we talked about the context of that last time. But here, there's no scriptural directive. So Paul begins, now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord. I give a judgment. Verse 26 says, I think it is good for you to remain as you are. Verse 40 at the end, in my judgment. This is Paul's opinion. It is not a scriptural directive. Why am I stressing this so much? Why is this so important? Simply because this passage has been used in cultures, in the church culture particularly, to cause great harm over many, many years. Many people have used Paul's personal opinion, his personal preference, to establish church doctrine. And that is simply wrong. It is taking it out of context. But that is not the end of the misuse that this passage has been placed on. Paul makes other statements. Statements that almost suggest that in his view, it is better not to be married. To suggest that singleness is actually the best option. He says, those who marry will face many troubles in this life. And I want to spare you from this. That's not very encouraging for anyone who's about to get married, is it? He speaks of people being married, being distracted from the Lord. What on earth is going on? That's got nothing to do with dualism. That's got nothing to do with sex is bad. He actually seems to be suggesting that singleness is a little better. What's happening? Well, one context in this passage is dualism, but there is a second one going on. There's a second context that underlies the whole thing. And he refers to this from the very beginning, verse 26. Because of the present crisis. It's on that basis that he's giving all of this information. But it's just that that suggests that Paul believes that this present world is about to end imminently. The kingdom will come. The present world will pass away altogether. So you shouldn't get entangled in matters of the world. Don't enter into marriage if you haven't already done so. Just don't give a thought to grief. Don't give a thought to celebrating. The day of the Lord is almost upon us, and focus on that and nothing else. That's the impression that many people have given, is Paul's way of living, full stop. Is that true? Well, I do believe that there is a great deal of truth to that. Paul is very focused, but there is much more happening. There seems to be something else going on here, something that is even more urgent in his mind. At the time when he is writing, there was a devastating famine in this region. And both the Bible and historians of the day were writing about the horrendous nature of this devastating famine. So if you read chapter 16 of this very book, and then Romans 15, Paul speaks about how they were giving relief to those who were in Jerusalem. They were going through such a tough period. A secular historian, Tacitus, wrote this. He wrote that famine fell upon the entire Roman Empire. It was established that at one point there was no more than 15 days of food supply in the city of Rome itself. And Josephus, great historian from this period, records the consequences of famine in Jerusalem in really graphic terms. I wondered whether I should read this to you, but I will read it to you. I hope you've got a hard stomach. This is what he wrote. One woman who had lost everything but her baby to bloodthirsty Jews then killed her baby son and then roasted him and ate one half of him and kept the other half by her concealed. When the seditious men smelled the horrid scent of this food, they threatened her that they would cut her throat immediately if she did not show them what food she had already gotten. She replied that she had saved a very fine portion of it for them and uncovered what was left of her son. She said, "This is my own son, and he was killed by my own doing. Come, eat of this food. I have eaten of it myself." The men left, trembling and frightened, and all the city came under distress when they heard about it. Horrific. But I share that with you to give you a sense of the calamity that is facing the Roman Empire. Think about it. These people have recognized Rome as being the mighty empire that will never fail. They'd expected Rome to provide for their every need, for food. The army will never be conquered. They're supremely confident, and it is all apparently falling apart, and people are panicking. I wonder if that had something to do with Paul's thinking about end times even, and others, and how similarly people think today, and were thinking at the time of the Cuba Missile Crisis, and today because of IS, and the nature of the potential economic crisis. It is as though Paul makes his comments in the light of both this immediate crisis that is influencing Corinth and the fact that it points and reminds, it points towards the ultimate crisis, the coming of the Lord once again. And he's using the Lord's coming to emphasize what our attitude should be even to these immediate crises, the famine. He's saying Christians need to wake up and recognize that things will never be simply casual. And that is true for us. We cannot be complacent, just the words used in the prayer time this morning. We cannot be complacent in this world. Not just because we don't know what's happening in times today, though people have said that thousands of times over the years, but because the Lord is going to come. This is significant. And the eternal future of the people that we care so much about really is on the line. We can never afford to just be complacent and take life easy. Like it just does not matter. And perhaps that's why he's suggesting to them that in this present crisis that may not last forever, but that does hint at what is going to come, maybe they should just wait, hang on before they make certain decisions. And he puts these two contexts together, and we see Paul not dictating terms for marriage that would affect the church forever, but he's showing genuine pastoral concern for people who are going through really tough times. He seems to be arguing, I'll use his words if I may, I agree it's good for some to remain single because those who do marry will face challenges, and especially because of the present crisis. And we don't know what he means by that. I wish he did. It'd be really intriguing, wouldn't it, to know just how he thinks married couples are going to really struggle. Though obviously there is a distraction. But to marry, he says, isn't sinful. And he affirms marriage, slapping down those who would say that dualism says marriage is bad. So that's the message, that's the point that he's coming to. But this passage has caused so much stress within the church. It causes some who want to remain single to become really anxious about God's will for their future lives. And for those people, they need to hear again that marriage or singleness lies completely out of the area, the arena in which God does make demands or commandments of us. It lies outside sinfulness or obedience. Those come down to personal choices within the normal rules of obedience that we would obviously follow in relationships. Paul's preference, therefore, is not based on something he wants us to make doctrine, but it's based on pastoral concern. And I want to add to that a second pressure that has therefore crept into the church, that we somehow then tend to think of marriage as a norm and that singleness is almost a second-class option. But the point is this, here's the reminder to us through this passage, the choice is entirely ours. Single people need to be able to live in Christian community without suspicion and with complete acceptance and affirmation. And I don't think the church in our nation is particularly good at doing that. We get so wound up on status and we put pressure on other people because of what society around considers status and because what people have misinterpreted in this passage about status. But I don't want to quite end at this point because we cannot avoid this expression in the passage, time is short. What on earth does he really mean by that? I want to encourage us to think about it as this. Let's think about Paul saying time is short as being the time for Christians to do what they need to do in God's kingdom work. Whether it be before this crisis that's coming, if one is for them and for us, or the fact that the Lord one day will return, time is short. It is about focusing our attentions and recognizing where our priorities come. It challenges to rethink our entire existence in the light of the present age coming to an end. Has God got your attention in that area? Whether it comes to our marriages or the little kingdoms that we establish, and by that I mean our families, our careers, our homes, our possessions, all of that stuff. When the Lord comes again, none of that will matter. It will not matter what our status is. It won't matter whether we followed the patterns of relationships or careers that the world would expect of us, that it says is normal or not. What will matter is that we have been faithful to the Lord in whatever situation we have found ourselves in. And so in verses 29 to 31, he speaks of Christians living in a particular way. He uses five examples, five as if nots, as if nots. So he talks about those who have wives to live as if they had not. Those who mourn as if they were not. Those if they were happy as if they were not. Those who buy as if it was not theirs to keep. Those who use the world as if they were not engrossed in the world. Again, can I encourage you? Don't take it too literally. He isn't really spinning things on his head and saying, if you're married, live as though your wife isn't there. Try it. Boy, you'll soon be in trouble. He's not saying that. Would that completely contradict anything else that he's already written in the book of Ephesus, for example? What he's saying is make sure that who you are and what you do is not dictated by those things. They don't determine your life and what is significant, most significant in your life. Jesus does. That's the key. And we so often forget it and get wrapped up in what used to be called the rat race. And the rat race, we often think about as, you know, financial rat race, keeping up with the Joneses, but we do it in all sorts of other ways, to do with our families, to the attention that we give to them, and to do with the prestige that we have of status in all sorts of areas. Look to Jesus. In our society, and even in the church, in the subculture of Christians, we get so hung up on status. But all of these things, whether it be marriage or celibacy, whether it be mourning or rejoicing, whether it be buying or whether it be using, all these things belong to a world that is passing away. So why get hung up on them? And we also get hung up, don't we, on the good life. So you could add to that list our health, our careers, our possessions, our success, all those sorts of things as well that we see as being so crucial, that tie us in knots because we've got to go to Weight Watchers to keep on top of things. All of that stuff. The world is absorbed with those matters. Christians are free from them. Take your freedom and enjoy it. And recognize your Lord. Give him your concentration. If you knew the world would end next week, would you be in the least concerned about all of those sorts of issues? Your status maritally, state of your home, whether your car's rusting away or not, would you really be that bothered? As Paul says in verse 35, he's not wanting them to restrict them in life, but he's wanting to encourage them to live with the right perspective, and in as much as it is possible to do so, to live in undivided devotion to the Lord. And incidentally, that's why we have that awkward little bit at the back, at the very end of the passage, I think it's the final verse, where he speaks once again a short note to widows. And he reminds them that their marriage is for life, but if a husband dies, they are free to marry anyone. That, first of all, is just a tick to slap down again those who say don't get married, but it's also a nod to those who think that Christians should still be living by the Levitical code, you know, whereby if your husband died and you didn't have any children, you had to marry their brother-in-law. Remember that? And he's saying, no, you're free to marry anyone. But look at the proviso. But they must be in the Lord. A believer. There's no indication that this has suddenly changed and that that is actually a command. But it is Paul's strongest urging. For him, it's just unimaginable to do otherwise. And here's why. If being married to a believer will distract us from devoted service, and especially when things are tough, that's what he's written. How much more challenging when our spouse
has a radically different value system and set of priorities. It's not easy, but Paul's wanting to help people. Well, we started by thinking about a Hollywood film, a film that was all about what was going to come. The challenge from Paul here is this: what is going to come should for you be having a really deep impact. It should be having an impact on everything that you do, in everything that occupies your time, everything that takes your focus, your attentions, your energy, your emotions, and your decision making. Whatever it is, the fact that the Lord is coming again and time is short should be focusing your attentions. The urgency of being about the Lord's work should be our focus. And everything else is a distraction. I want to encourage us to reassess. There are no rules here. There is guidelines, and there's a plea from Paul that we recognize the importance of what the Lord has for us. Don't get conned by the enemy dangling his carrot of life and what it should be like in our cushy, soft little England. Don't get conned by what family expectations are. Be clear, when the Lord comes, and it could be tomorrow morning, their expectations and the country's and the nation's expectations count for nothing. When the Lord comes, our status before God is everything. And those who do not know the Lord will have to stand before their Maker. That should focus our minds and our attentions. And that should challenge us to be these beacons of prayer that the General Secretary of the BU speaks about in this path, in the diaries that you've got. And it should focus our attention to be on your knees for those in our fellowship who don't know the Lord, for those in our fellowship who are having opportunities to impact at Welshwood and the messy church amongst toddlers. We should be focusing our energies and asking God, Lord, what do you want me to do in service for you? Because time is short.